You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the only good man is a dead man. Wait, that's a wrong show. We haven't been taken over yet. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you are a good man, you're probably a zombie. So why don't you bite some other people so we can get some more listeners to the show, some more zombie listeners to the show? Because that's the only way you would listen to the show if you were brain dead, right? So why don't you tell a friend and leave a brain dead 5-star review? Or how about everyone just leave a review on iTunes 5 stars, just put brains. That's what we'll do this week. Brains on iTunes 5-star review. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Hi. Every year, this story gets published. It's about who pays income tax, and every year I get more and more pissed off because I pay a lot of income tax. And here's the numbers for this year, Justin, so you can also be pissed off. The top 50% of all taxpayers, I assume that includes you, although I don't know. The top 50% of all taxpayers paid 97% of total individual income tax in 2016, which are the latest numbers we have. And here's the fun one. The top 1% paid a greater share of individual income tax, 37.3%, than the bottom 90% combined. Pay your fair share, Richie Rich McRicherson. Pay your fair share. Oh, I hate it all. I hate it all. I hate Elizabeth Warren. I hate Beto O'Rourke. I hate Kamala Harris. I hate Booker, whatever his first name is, Corey. Corey! You know he's going to be terrible if his first name is Corey. Sorry, Midsider Corey, if we have one out there.
Corey Matthews would disagree with you.
Yeah.
Aren't I automatically in the top 50% because I live in California?
Could be. I don't know what the actual, where the breakdown is. It's just crazy to think about, and to really concretize it, the richest 1,400 taxpayers paid more taxes than the bottom 70 million taxpayers. 70 million. Pay your fair share. Fair share. Okay, I'm done ranting.
This intro brought to you by Liberty.me.
Taxation is theft.
Also joining us from Dale's lawn, identifying as a woman to forego his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, we survived the rainstorm. My heart goes out to all of you guys dealing with the hurricane on the East Coast, but you have to understand we had 0.4 inches of rain, which meant that 10,000 were left without power for a short time in downtown LA. And a tree fell in my street. Thankfully, the truck that was crushed looks like it was probably worth about $100. But I feel bad for that poor person who got his truck crushed by a very slowly falling tree.
William, if a tree falls in Los Angeles and it doesn't hit a Mexican's truck, does anyone notice?
I think you couldn't have fallen in any direction and probably had hit a truck by a gardener in my neighborhood.
You don't know he was a gardener. He could have been a cook at a restaurant.
You know, it is odd to carry like a bunch of rakes and stuff in the back of your truck if you're a cook. But, you know, I don't know. You're right.
At the trendy restaurants in LA, you never know.
I will have you know, William, there was lightning in the sky and thunder could be heard, okay? That is a rainstorm of epic proportions in California.
Yeah, there were everyone in the neighborhood was sitting on their deck or standing just under their overhangs to observe this quote-unquote thunderstorm.
No wonder Southern Californians are obsessed with climate change. The moment their climate has any change whatsoever, they flip out.
Well, that's what I've always said. That's why they believe in climate change, because they're used to it always being the same. So now that it's not always the same, they think something must be wrong.
Jeez. Could it get any worse there, honestly? I guess Gavin Newsom will.
Yeah, we've got nowhere to go but down.
I don't know. I mean, you ask.
Isn't that what he said to his secretary?
Oh,
ooh, zing! Oh. Hashtag me too.
Yeah, you're really leading into the news here, Daniel, because you're bringing up that, and then also the idea that things could they get worse. Oh, they could, as we're about to see. They're going to give it the real college try, pun intended here. They're giving it the real college try to make things worse. Let's find out how in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
CNN about exploded this week when, during an interview, Melania Trump said that women need evidence if they're going to say they're victims of sexual assault. Indeed, First Lady Melania Trump, who was giving an interview, I don't know with whom, it doesn't really say, ABC, sorry, said that if you accuse someone of something, show the evidence. Indeed. She says, I support the women and they need to be heard, but we need to support them and, you know, also men, not just women. I do stand with women, but we need to show the evidence. You cannot just say to somebody, I was sexually assaulted or you did that to me, because sometimes the media goes too far and the way they portray some stories, it's not correct. It's not right. So, of course, CNN melted down, pointing out Trump's Access Hollywood tape where he suggested you, if you were a celebrity, women just let you, you know, handle them in certain places. But is what she said really all that controversial, Justin?
What does it say, Daniel, about our culture that we're now to the point that we say it's controversial to say if you claim something, you need evidence to back it up? That's controversial. That's controversial. Now, let me be clear here. Let me be clear. To say you're a victim, you don't need evidence. You can say you're a victim. I can say I'm a purple people eater. I can say I played for the Super Bowl champions. I need evidence if I want people to believe me. And that's the problem, is in this victim-based culture where the more of a victim you are, the more of the rewards you reap. And the rewards are mainly social, where everyone's like, oh, I feel so bad for you. Let's do what you need. Oh, we're going to believe you. Hashtag believe all women. They want to be believed no matter what, just by claiming something. We are now living in a society where you cannot just claim that you're a victim of something, but anything you want to claim is true. You can watch a movie and say, oh, well, that was about the complete opposite about what it was actually about. But because I said it, I have to be believed because that's what I think, or worse, that's what I feel. So all she's doing is pushing back against the emotionalist culture. And by the way, I don't think we've ever said anything about Melania Trump on this show before. So, Melania Trump, you are one for one in the mid-side. Maybe this is why you don't talk often, because unlike your husband, you realize only say something when you have something worthwhile to say. And you said a really good thing. Fuck emotionalism. Anyone who disagrees with Melania Trump, this goes back to what we talked about last week in Life on the Mid-Side. You are on the other side of things, and you have proven to me you're not even worth talking to. All she's saying is, this is serious. We need to treat it as if it's serious. I am with them. If we can prove they're victims, they need to be taken seriously, which is all 100% correct, but they need evidence. And then people flip out. Well, evidence, evidence, evidence. Who needs evidence? Guilty until proven innocent.
Yes. One thing I want to note about this article, William, before I get into something serious about it, is that they go back and forth talking about Melania and Donald Trump in this article and only use the last name Trump.
That sounds sexist to me.
That is horrifyingly bad journalism. My Journalism 101 teacher would fail this writer. But getting back to, you know, things that have our points and whatnot, I don't even know what it means necessarily, William, to stand with the accusers and then demand evidence. This is what we talked about last week, which is you have an accusation. That can be handled by police or not. But don't you stand with people because of evidence and not just because they claim victimhood? Why would you stand with them if they had no evidence just because of their claims? It's something I don't quite get.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, I would say testimony can be evidence, right? Like if someone tells you what happened, you take that into account. But when we're talking about something as damning as, you know, let's take it out of the sexually charged realm. Like if someone says so-and-so murdered my brother, like you would want some claims to back that up, right? You would want some outside other than that person telling you to back that up. And that's not unreasonable to ask for. And it's different than empathizing, right? Like I think we see there's a lot of like mixing of behaviors together. I can empathize with someone who really genuinely feels they're a victim because I don't know what's going on in their head, and I can only take what they say as about their emotional state. You know, I can see some of that. You know, you see it on their face, you see it in their body. But you don't, you know, I can empathize with the emotion, right? But if we start talking about what actually happened and you want me to judge someone else based on what you're saying, I'm going to need more. And I don't think that's unreasonable. And that's not invalidating what people are experiencing.
Yeah, Justin, it seems to me that this is a quest for the unearned. And in this instance in particular, it's unearned ethos. So if you, for instance, Justin or William, were to come up to me and say, hey, that guy over there assaulted me, or that woman over there assaulted me, it's not because I hashtag believe all men or hashtag believe all victims. It's because
or hashtag
I
believe
know
all gays.
You, right. Or straights in Justin's case.
Thank you
straight,
for that qualification. I appreciate
straight
that.
Edges. Straight edges.
Yeah, even better.
It's because I hashtag believe Justin Lesneski or hashtag believe William Green. Because I know you and I understand who you are as a human being. And part of who you are as a human being is there's no evidence that I've seen that you've lied to me about things. But I don't have that same reaction to Christine Blasey Ford or any random person. Ethos isn't automatic. Character isn't automatic. It has to be earned. And it seems to me that this believe all victims thing is a quest for the unearned. And in this case, the unearned ethos.
Well, that ethos, the unearned ethos, goes all the way back to relativism and emotionalism, because emotionalism and relativism is all about you construct reality based upon what you think, right? Well, that's mm-hmm. that's unearned ethos as all. That's making yourself godlike in a way. So everyone is going back to that, where they just want to be believed based upon what they think. And you could even argue, or even what they feel, even worse. And you could even argue, and I think we do in the judicial system, that you want to be judged not purely on your ethos. It's dangerous to have an ethos-based society because we have a jury of our peers, but we have a jury of our peers who don't know us and aren't familiar with the case. We do that intentionally so that people can look at purely the evidence rather than be biased one way or the other. Because, I mean, look at the example of the O.J. Simpson case, right? He had a very good ethos.
Careful.
This has nothing to do with race. He had a very good ethos. He was a heroic person with the way he played in the NFL. He did things that we generally consider heroic. So he had a good ethos. So people were more likely to believe he wouldn't kill someone. And some of the worst people in the history of the world, Hitler, have done that. They build up a good ethos and then use that ethos as an excuse to do horrible things. So this use of ethos is even dangerous. Isn't that how sociopaths get ahead?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's to me, that's why the development of ethos and the expectation of it has to be based on something. Has to be based on actions. It can't just be based on, I mean, people say like, hey, you know, why don't you do this for me, whatever, because we're friends. And this will be someone, for instance, who I've known on Facebook for 7 years and have maybe spoken to all of once. It's like, we're not friends. You know, we see each other's posts on Facebook, on social media. That doesn't make us friends. It makes us acquaintances at best. But I'm more friendly with, you know, my dog's walker than I am with this person who I've been quote-unquote friends with on Facebook, because it has to be based on something. It can't be based on time or proximity. It has to be based on action. So hashtag believe all actions.
Actions and values and where they meet is, I think, the important thing. These are people. I mean, look at this is a perfect example, especially with the way this has been politicized. People with the opposite values of you who have taken no actions to create any sort of world that you would want to live in expect you to believe them at face value.
Yeah. Indeed. That's pretty scary. Well, you know what else is scary? This, I would call it an opinion piece, but it's really a screed in the Washington Post. Journalism is dead. I'll say that one more time. Here we go. This is the headline of an opinion piece in the Washington Post, or I should call it the formerly respectable Washington Post. Quote, "Thanks for not raping us, all you good men, but it's not enough." Okay, so the opinion piece is by Victoria Bissell Brown, who's a retired history professor at Grinnell College, don't know where that is, and was published this week. It starts like this. "I yelled at my husband last night. Not pick up your socks yell. Not how could you ignore that red light yell. This was real yelling. This was 30 minutes of from the gut yelling, triggered by a small, thoughtless, dismissive, annoyed, patronizing comment. Really small, a microwave that triggered a hurricane. I blew hard and fast, and it terrified me. I'm still terrified what I felt and what I said. I'm almost 70 years old, I'm a grandmother, yet in the roiling moment, screaming at my husband, as if he represented every clueless male on the planet, and I, every woman of 2018, I announce that I hate all men and wish all men were dead. If one of my grandchildren yelled something that ridiculous, I'd have to stifle a laugh." She goes on to recount that her husband and she have been married for 50 years, and he is a good man who listens to women respectfully, etc. But this is... where she goes with it. "In the centuries of feminist movements that have washed up and away, good men have not once organized their own mass movement to change themselves and their sons, or to attack the mean-spirited, teasing, punching thing that passes for male culture. Not once. Bastards. Don't listen to me. Listen to each other. Talk to each other. Earn your power for once. The gender war that has broken out in this country is flooding all our houses. It's rising on the torrent of memories that every woman has." She goes into a Christine Blasey Ford rant, and she says, "No man right now understands that flood is rushing through the women's brains, and only women in the deepest denial have evacuated their minds before the flood could reach them." Justin, what the hell did he say?
I'm glad you asked that question, because to me, that is the most damning thing about this entire article. She doesn't even say what he said. He probably said something innocuous, like he probably like was upset with her about something. Like, would you stop leaving that where you leave it? And then she got upset that he dared tell her what to do. How dare you tell me what to do? And then she goes into all men must die because of that. I mean, this is absurd, okay? This entire thing, it's just so revealing. Look at the article. Look at fundamentally what she wants. She wants men not to be men anymore. That's what's hidden in here. You elucidated it. You brought it out. Elucidated? I never say that word properly. you brought it out. She fundamentally wants men to change. Men never get together and change who men are. That's what she says. She's saying men are terrible because they keep being men. And yes. Then there's also something interesting in here that I really think needs to be named, because when I was in Boston a couple Januaries ago and I was wandering around and there was that anti-Trump pro-women march after Trump had been elected in that January, I noticed this, and this article confirmed it again. Can we stop these old women from leading the younger women around like these older women know something? Like, fundamentally, you're 70 years old. You don't think things have changed since then? And I'm not saying she lived in a rape culture back then. I'm not giving this, you know, this argument that the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s were horrible towards women validity. I'm saying, you know, they're probably not as good as they are now. Things have gotten better. But this idea that what they experienced 70 years ago is still valid to what these 20-year-olds are experiencing now, to what these 30-year-olds are experiencing now, I mean, fucking, it takes everything in me just to not be like, die. This is a woman who lived in the 60s and 70s and never let go of that. That's how she conformed her identity. That's how she formed her identity, I mean. That's how she created her identity, and she has not let it go. And now she's openly admitting to abusing her husband. You know, in the article, she's like, oh, you know, you can tell. You know, at least he sat there and listened to me. He sat there and listened to you because you've beaten him down like a dog for 50 years, and he's learned when you go on one of these rants to just shut the fuck up or make things worse.
Yeah, never did you think you'd publish a transcript in the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Not, you know, angrygrandma.zanga.com, but the Washington Post. William.
Didn't they try to make a show Shit My Dad Said and everyone said it was stupid? Now we're publishing Shit My Grandma Said and it's fine?
Yes, indeed. William, does this woman make you glad that you're gay?
Well, I wonder, because she said that men have never taken... what was the exact quote? Men had never undertaken a movement to improve themselves.
Yeah. Isn't in all the waves all, of feminism and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't all of human history a clash between men who are trying to do that and men who are trying to not do that? I mean, can't we look at history that way? And then even forget that for a second. There were men's movements in the 60s and 70s, and there were Promise Keepers in the 90s, and there was, didn't Billy Graham have one in the 80s? Like, these are all things that existed, right? Like, we're not living in some alternative feminist history, right? We're living in real history that actually happened. Like, these things happened, right? And, yeah, I think that I should be offended, right? Because apparently all men are seeking to rape women. Does that mean that I fall into that category?
I guess you do. I guess you just secretly want to, and you don't even know it.
Getting thanks or like declining thanks in that case then? Like, how would that interaction work? So Daniel, you be the woman that's going to thank me for not raping them.
Okay, here we go. William, I want to deeply and personally thank you for not raping me.
Wait, why would I rape you?
Well, because you're a man. Yeah, but you're a good man, so you're not.
Well, but I mean, but you're missing some things I'm interested in. It wouldn't even, like, there's no possibility of me even, you know, being sexually attracted William. To you. Like, why would that ever
William.
Go?
Hashtag believe all women, William.
Oh, okay.
How dare you, William? You're saying that she is not sexually attracted. You are body shaming her? You are person shaming
exactly.
her?
Exactly. Exactly. Yep.
Am I not worthy of
being raped?
It gets weird real quick.
Exactly. The whole interaction, it doesn't make any sense, right? Like, it's funny because when someone, this comes up a lot, right? This kind of, well, what do you want me to do? Thank you for not raping women?
Wait, careful. What comes up a lot?
My penis. But also this idea of, do you want me to thank you for not raping women comes up a lot. And I think that the reason it comes up again is this sort of like mixed concept, right? When we start talking about typical male behavior that we're like, hey, like, look, these males are not doing that typical behavior. Then the retort is always, well, what do you want? A thank you for not raping women, right? And Justin, I'm wondering, like, what's the connection? There's some sort of connection there, right? Like, there's an injustice going on there where we're saying, hey, look, there's behaviors that are natural to men. Not that rape is, but right, like there's natural behavior around being a male that we're controlling and we're civilizing. Shouldn't we get credit for that? And that turns into, well, thank you for not raping me.
Yeah. I don't know, Justin, the suppressed premise of that to me really bothers me because it's collectivist, right? At its core, it's basically saying, you don't get credit for not doing the things that all the other members of your gender do. So it's sort of collectivist in a couple different ways. I don't know. reaction.
Well, yeah, it's fundamentally collectivist. I mean, it's what I was saying. They fundamentally don't want you to be men. I mean, really, what this lady is saying is she just wants a bunch of women running around. That's what it is. She wants to be on, what's the name of Wonder Woman's island?
The Isle of Lesbos?
Basically, I can't remember the name. It's like Thermopylae or something. What the fuck is it called?
It's not Thermopylae. Those are some hot gates.
You know what I'm talking about, though. What the fuck is the island called?
I don't know. Don't you have a computer in front of you?
It's Gamora.
Gamora? Yeah, it's Gamora. It's Gamora. All right.
You know, that sounds like, you know, if there's actually a Christian hell, I think that's where I'm going, is the land only containing women. So...
Wonder Woman Island. Now that you made it so I'm Googling this on air, but
makes,
yeah,
good pod.
Themyscira. There you go. Thermopylae wasn't that far off. I was right with the first three letters or first four letters. Fuck off. But yeah, that's ultimately what she wants. She wants to live on Themyscira. That's all this is. I mean, that's what they're revealing fundamentally deep down. They want men not to be men anymore.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's also a matter of like, well, what do you... So here's a paragraph that should give anyone pause if they think this woman has a point, which is this. Quote, when good men like Senator Christopher Coons give heartfelt, sincere speeches about how we must listen to women, I don't know whether to coo or laugh or cry or yell. Think about Listen to Women as a program for change. It says to women, you will continue to suffer these abuses. Men will continue to do disgusting things to you. The storms will keep coming. The tide will continue to rise. But now we will listen and help you rebuild. What?
Well, again, the collectivism is just seeping all out of that, right? Like, which men, right? Is it literally all men? Is there no, like, no redeeming quality to any man in existence? Like, what are you talking about here?
It's just...
Don't you gotta
imagine if I did that in my life and I said, and I looked at the kinds of things that I endured about being gay and applied that to all straight people. Yeah. That would be like something like what, 97% of the population I would just hate? Yeah. Be constantly looking over my shoulder, waiting to be, you know, bashed and insulted. How could I live my life? What a terrible state to live in.
Aren't there gay guys that do that, though?
There are some. I remember being on a date with someone who was super nervous about going to a straight bar because I was holding their hand. And I was like, dude, I've been in this bar 1,000 times. This, like, maybe if we were like in some random bar in the backwoods of some hick town in Michigan, maybe I wouldn't hold your hand, right? Maybe we'd test the waters first and maybe, you know, something like that. But no, I was taken aback. I was like, how do you live your life like this? We're not in Saudi Arabia, right?
This is in America. Saying, comes in though. Go ahead, Daniel.
I just keep saying, I don't live in the same world as these people. I don't live on the same planet.
Well, they have a response for that, right? You're not a woman.
Okay, my wife apparently also doesn't live on the same planet as this woman. I mean, I just don't understand how delightfully aloof my wife is. And I mean it sincerely. It is delightful. The other day I explained to her what hashtag Me Too was. So one, she didn't know because she doesn't care. And two, she was utterly disgusted by the concept. And she had the same sort of reaction. Like, who are these people interacting with that they're being raped all the time? Like, what kind of people do you have in your life that you're sexually assaulted constantly, apparently? Like, she doesn't experience this world. Who lives in this world?
When I try to say some stuff like that, that I get told that I have straight privilege, right? That's what I get told.
Okay.
Right, privilege is the trump card for that.
Yeah, privilege is always the trump card for that.
And Daniel, when you're talking about this, I'm about to steal a joke right now. When you're talking about hashtag Me Too, this is where it gets weird because we have this 7-year-old woman ranting and she probably doesn't even know that that's a hashtag. She just sees it as a pound. So she thinks the whole movement is pound Me Too. And things get really weird from that point on.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's very weird. All right. Well, let's transition away from rape.
Oh, wait, Daniel, and, I had something I wanted to say before we continue, because I have a very serious point to make here.
Oh, God.
No, this is 100% serious. I don't know why you're afraid. This is something that I am actually very afraid of right now, and I am very worried about going forward. And because of what you and your wife said, that it makes it even more important to say. This woman said the word war. She said there is a gender war on. And we are literally living in a society where people look at Ford's testimony, they look at Kavanaugh's testimony, and they have diametrically opposed views. You know, Daniel and Faiza, you guys sit there and you say, we're living in a different world where this doesn't even exist. And this is the question I ask all of you midsiders out there. And I ask this, complete seriousness. How do you reconcile this divide without violence? How? Now, I'm not advocating violence, but I'm saying when two immovable objects come up against each other and they have diametrically opposed views and they see the same thing and neither side can be convinced because they literally are perceiving reality 180 degrees different, how do you resolve that conflict without bloodshed?
Yeah, and just so that no one takes you just so no one takes you out of context, you're not saying that evil doesn't exist. You're not saying that rapists don't exist, that people who sexually assault people don't exist. What you're saying is that this systemic privilege versus, you know, this all-out war where all men are, no matter what action they take, are acting against the interests of all women. That is the thing that does not exist.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, 100%. I'm saying that all men are not rapists. I'm saying there's not a rape culture. But I'm saying there are people who say there's a rape culture. And just like Melania Trump, right? Because let's ground this in the first article. Just like Melania Trump, I'm saying that the women who are attacked and who are victims need justice and they need the care so they can overcome it and lead a healthy life again. But we can't even treat them the way they deserve and get them to get the help they deserve and punish the men that do these things and, you know, the women who do it to the men too. Punish the perpetrators because we're not seeing the world properly. And when you get to that point that there are two sides that are seeing things that oppositely, and I'm not even saying the two sides are saying women aren't raped and women are raped. I'm saying exactly what I just said. Half of the side saying it's not collectivist and all men aren't evil, and the other side saying all men are evil. When you get to that point, how can this end anyway besides bloodshed? And I'm not advocating bloodshed. I'm just saying, don't we have to be worried? Because I am.
Well, that's depressing. I don't think we have to be worried immediately, because I still don't think this is mainstream culture yet. Unfortunately, I think it moves that way. It moves that direction because there's no countercultural force really to stop it. There's no enlightenment movement to push against it. There's no rational, scientific, natural rights-based movement to give a counter. Now, I'm being a little over the top because obviously there is, this show is part of it in a certain sense, but it's tiny. It's very small.
And every time it happens and gets any traction, it's decried as William said, privileged or evil. Yeah. I mean,
but we do have collectivist responses too, which are going to be ineffectual. Yes. Right? We see that on the racial quote unquote side of the politics.
Yes.
We see Proud Boys, for example, which is a mixed group, and then you have the super far right racial nationalists, right? Your Spencers of the world versus Antifa and BLM, right? You don't see there's no prominent group that's taking the mid-side position, right? That say, hey, both you guys are bullshit. You're missing a lower level philosophical issue.
Well, you can't. That's my point, is because anytime anyone tries to start the discussion, they're immediately lumped into that opposite category of the Proud Boys and the white nationalists and the quote-unquote alt-right, as they call it. I mean, I think about the most prominent example to me of this, the most perfect example to me of this is The Red Pill by KCJ, where it was literally a woman who started exploring these ideas and saw something that she didn't think she would see, and she just made an honest documentary about it. And then what did everyone say about her? And has the documentary picked up steam? No. But it should have.
Well, and just to be clear, I don't think I think there's a huge difference between the Proud Boys and someone like Richard Spencer. I see them as mixed more to the middle, what would be the middle if we weren't so, the Overton window wasn't so far to the left. But yeah, I agree with the underlying point there is that we don't see, you don't see in the media that taken hold, but I think that you do see it somewhat developing in the counterculture on the internet. And I think that's a good sign. I think that's, yeah, the, I don't think that's the more rational response.
It's just
right?
Small.
Yeah. It's small, but it doesn't take a lot to make a change. Yeah.
Well, we'll see where it goes as well. Oh boy. All right. Thanks for that downer, Justin. Okay. Let's uplift ourselves with some more farce.
Even, the next article is even relevant to it. How is this next article not leading us towards war? Tell me that.
How about we get to it?
Man, you're all Andrew Breitbart today, Justin. Throwback.
I'm not Breitbart.
That's his whole thing was it's a war, literally a cultural war, and it will end in bloodshed. Eventually.
Well, the dude's right, so.
And he was assassinated for it. No, he wasn't. He died of natural cause. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. Okay. This is a Vox article. It's called The Case for Abolishing the Supreme Court. A Harvard law professor on whether it's time to rethink the nation's highest court. Of course, this comes in the wake of Justice Kavanaugh and all that, and the threat that Roe v. Wade may now be overturned, or at least diminished in some way. So this is how the article begins. When he was arguing for the ratification of the Constitution, Alexander Hamilton wrote that the judiciary, quote, will always be the least dangerous branch to the political rights of the Constitution, end quote, in part because he believed that the federal courts would stand above the political fray and act as a bulwark against tyranny from all directions. But it's hard to defend the Supreme Court on these grounds today. As my colleague Matt Iglesias noted last week, the court is now a blunt political instrument used repeatedly to undermine outcomes of democratic governance, often on behalf of corporate interests. And the recent disaster that was the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation has further delegitimized the court in the public's mind. So it's perfectly reasonable to ask if we should abolish the Supreme Court, or at the very least, strip the court of its ability to overturn laws that it rules unconstitutional. If the court is no longer a neutral arbiter of the law, if it's gradually shape-shifting into a partisan weapon, then maybe it's time to rethink its role in our constitutional system. Oh boy, Justin. There's a lot to unpack there, and there's a lot I want to get into, but before I do any of that, what do you think? Does he have some legitimate gripes here with the court?
Wait, so does he have legitimate gripes that the system has worked exactly as the system was designed to work, and because it doesn't do what he wants it to do, then it's bad?
That's
your question?
That is typically the kind of leading question that I would ask. Yes, I've been trying not to do that this week.
I mean, look, dude, this is no different from the way people treat the Patriots. This is ultimately revealing the way the media works. Is that where you thought I was going to go?
No, but I assumed the Patriots would come up in the news segment at some point.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't talked football yet, and it's already, what are we, 20 minutes in? Yeah.
Well, look, it's exactly the same thing, where if you go over and over again, and you accuse them of cheating, and then you go, well, if they're cheating, shouldn't they be punished? And then you punish them when they haven't done anything wrong. This is what the media does. This is what the left wing does. They repeat over and over again a myth to get people to accept it. And then because people accept that myth, they then say, oh, look at this thing you should do because of it. You know, if there's smoke, there's fire. Well, you're the motherfucker that lit the fire.
We didn't start the fire. Okay. William, specifically, I want to ask you about a particular phrase in here, because it's one that I'm about to rant on after you're done discussing. And that is this. He says that the court has been used to, quote, undermine outcomes of democratic governance. And he says often on behalf of corporate interests. What is he getting at there, and what the hell does that actually mean?
I think that that's the nut of the confusion in this article. We do not live in a democracy. We live in a republic. And there's a huge difference between the two. There's a reason why our court system is set up the way that it is. And God bless it. It slows us down from doing irrational things. It also looks to our conceptual foundation of our rights, which is written in the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Federalist Papers, to interpret laws as we increase our knowledge and understanding of human nature and technology and engineering, all sorts of areas of life. The court's role is a political one with judicial review. And I'm gonna turn that question back to you. I know you have a rant saved up, but I was looking at all these arguments that these people are talking about. Haven't we seen all of those arguments since 1803, since Mayberry versus Madison? None of these arguments are new about the court.
No, none of them are new. The founders anticipated it. The founders wrote extensively about it. The Federalists and the Anti-Federalists debated this at length before the ratification of the Constitution. And this is what I have so many things to say about this article.
Well, I have one more question for you, though, before you get into that. And maybe not everyone gets educated quite like they should in civics class, but what is the recourse? If the court declares something unconstitutional, what can you do? Daniel, what do you do?
Well, one is you make it constitutional.
Exactly. Really we have a democratic amendment, quote unquote, process to change the law. Just because something's unconstitutional doesn't mean you can't change the Constitution. We've seen it. We've done it how many times? 27 times? What are we up to now? We've done it many times.
Yeah. It's been done quite a bit. Not so much recently, but it's been done historically quite a bit.
Here's Daniel, before your rant, I have a question.
All of you people are giving me
so much cock teasery before your rant. It better be a good
that's
one.
That's all right. We don't get Daniel rants very often. So I think my question will probably lead into your rant too. I'm just thinking. So the whole point of having three branches is checks and balances to make sure things don't go too far in one direction, correct?
Theoretically.
Well, we know how leftist the culture is. We know how leftist generally the government is. So isn't this all working perfectly if the court is more right-wing to stop everything from becoming super leftist? Didn't the founders get something right, perhaps?
Yeah, I don't even think you have to look at it in terms of left-right. You just have to look at it in terms of, proper government and improper government. And that partially does lead into my rant, although very softly. And this is the rant on this whole undermining outcomes of democratic governance crap. As William said, we're not a democracy. We're a republic. We're a constitutional federal republic. The point being that the Constitution outlines what the government is allowed to do. And the government is not allowed to do anything else at the federal level. And the 14th Amendment made it so that that Constitution applied to the states as well. Here's the thing. Left, you do not want the court demurring to whatever the hell this democratic governance crap is that you're spewing. Because you know when they have done that in the past? Plessy v. Ferguson, when they demurred to the fact that a slave was not a person but was property, because that was the law of the land. So they said, oh, Congress has settled this, so therefore slaves aren't people. You know what else they demurred to your crappy democratic governance? Korematsu, when FDR ordered Japanese Americans into internment camps during World War II, and the court upheld that decision, basically saying, oh, it's a legitimate executive order. What are we going to do about it? You know what else they demurred to your crappy democratic governance? In a case called Buck v. Bell, when the Supreme Court upheld forced sterilization of poor people, mainly minorities, on these grounds. This is a quote from then Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. three generations of imbeciles is enough. That is a quote by the Supreme Court of the United States upholding a democratic law. That is not what we want at all out of the Supreme Court. What we want out of the court, no.
I think I'm switching sides. Like, everything you just said just convinced me. I mean, I think I'm a pro-vox on this one.
So, Daniel, I have a...
What we want out of a court is for them to demolish things that trample on rights. We want them to excoriate them. We want them expunged from the record. And if and only if we can go through the process of any constitutional amendment, should that thing be allowed. And even in that case, we should revolt. But
Daniel, I have a question for you. I want to find something redeeming in this article. And and so let's look at there is some criticism about the quality of the decisions coming out of the court. And there's kind of a snide comment about it being bad. How do they put it? They put for something about it being being like law clerk.
Minimally competent legal analysis to extremely bad decisions that are announced without a clear, compelling explanation.
So I think there's a nugget of truth in here. I want to get your opinion on it. Sure. I do see that the court is overly circumscript on its decisions. And what I mean by that is they try to make the least amount of decision possible. And I think I understand why, but it often leads to just delaying what the actual outcome will be. And what I'm thinking about is like, in Citizens United is a good example. I think the gay cake case is a good example where they've been super razor thin on the amount of new decision that they make each decision. Do you think that that's maybe the nut of the criticism there? And is that valid?
So I don't think that's the nut of the criticism in this article. The nut of the criticism in this article is that the court has increasingly been what legal scholars would call originalist. Or really specifically, they've actually been textualist, which is they've actually looked at the text of the law and said, does the text of this law permit what the government wants to do? And if the answer is no, then the law is struck down or changed or whatever it is. The progressives hate this because it forces them to pass law, which they don't like to do. They'd much rather rule through
administrative action,
agencies, yep, yep, or court rulings, etc. So because it's difficult to pass law. And it's difficult to pass law that's consistent with what the government is allowed to do in the Constitution. Now, and I'll get to the more technical point in a moment, but the point being here that even progressives, I think, don't actually want a living constitution, or they don't want laws to mean whatever the hell we think they mean in the time, because remind you who the president is right now, progressives. Do you want the Constitution to mean what Donald Trump thinks the Constitution means? Do you want the Constitution to mean what someone worse than Donald Trump thinks the Constitution means? And also, who accepts living anything in their life? If you have a contract, Justin, and you're writing a video for some organization who might want to hire you to do that, and the contract says, you know, they'll pay you such and such dollars an hour, and then in 6 months they go, well, we interpret that to mean we're going to pay you half that. Oh, sorry, that's just what the words mean now. Would you accept that in your life? No, it's freaking ridiculous. Of course you understand that words have meaning and they mean something over time. And perhaps the meaning changes, but what did they mean when the thing was written? So that makes sense to me. And then finally, William, on your point
about... Wait, you asked me a question.
The court.
I have a response to your question.
Okay, please answer.
Isn't what you totally described how it question. Works in California?
Yeah. Well, via taxation, yes.
It's like, no, even with employers... Half. Even with employers, the last employer I worked for, when they got rid of me, they didn't pay me my full PTO because they had changed the PTO policy when I started, and then they tried to claim that I didn't fall under the new one because of my hire date, but then they told me I did, so it was never clear what actually the policy was and how it fit me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess California does do it. Now, to your point, William, about the court and the punting, there's a specific philosophy that the Chief Justice has. The philosophy can be summed up as judicial minimalism, which, if you were to say it in terms of like medical jargon, it would be essentially do no harm. That the court should do its job, i.e. review laws, but first and foremost, it should not hurt people. And so his philosophy has always been, since he's been the Chief Justice, what consensus can we build among the conservative and the liberal justices to make a decision on this very narrow, specific issue without causing broad, sweeping changes to American jurisprudence? And while I don't necessarily agree with that philosophy, especially in regards to really bad things like Obamacare and that kind of crap, I respect it more than what was going on in like the 70s and 80s, where the court would just wholesale make up things that had literally nothing to do with the law because, you know, it's time, or because people want it, or because the culture is ready, whatever stupid reasoning. That was the era, and especially before then, in like the 40s and 50s, those are the eras when they were just making up things with no, with minimal competent legal analysis, etc. At least today, the court is trying to find a small technical issue they can resolve, as opposed to mandating broad sweeping changes to our entire culture.
Well, thanks. So. That's pretty enlightening. I think if anyone wants to see an example of poor judicial writing, just read Roe versus Wade. What a tenuous legal document. It's completely indefensible, right? Not the right to abortion, right? Just to be clear, but how the pretzel they twisted themselves into to strike down those laws.
And this is why it's important. Because those crappy reasonings that don't actually protect our rights, the crappy analysis trying to shove rights into some stupid, nonsense, leftist worldview, means that those rights are more likely to be wiped out later by people who actually have brains. So when people say, you know, how can you be pro-choice and anti-Roe, it's because Roe doesn't do crap to protect rights. It does nothing. It is crappy analysis built on crappy analysis built on crappy analysis. And so was the gay marriage decision, William. So was Obergefell.
Absolutely.
The reasoning was, it's time. Love is love. It's time. So we might as well have it because it's time. What a crappy analysis. It's not going to hold up to anything. So I have a few thoughts on these issues, if you didn't notice. So, Justin, do you want to say anything in response? It is your show.
No, I think you're doing a good job carrying the load this episode, so have at it. I mean, I think the one thing I said carries a lot of weight, so I don't want to ruin it. Get your bunkers, ladies and gentlemen. Get your bunkers.
So, let's move on to my favorite story of the week. Yes, it is my favorite story of the week because there are so many elements of absurdity here. Banksy, the street graffiti artist, whatever you want to call him, shredded a piece of art that sold for $1.4 million, and now it's probably worth double that, according to experts. So anyone who didn't see this story, you need to look up the video. You need to Google it right now. It's fun. So Sotheby's in London was auctioning off Banksy's Girl with Balloon print, which is one of his most famous prints. It's a little girl. She's holding a red balloon. It's what passes as art.
99 red balloons.
And the canvas, which was not owned by Banksy because he sold it to someone else, was in an ornate frame, sort of oddly ornate for a Banksy painting. And once the painting hit $1.4 million and the gavel hit to sell the painting, the piece of art slides down the bottom through a built-in shredder in the frame and shreds about half of the work, leaving the other half exposed. This was all an elaborate prank set up by Banksy himself, obviously. Now there's lots of questions about whether or not Sotheby's was in on it and whether or not the buyer has to buy this or whether or not Banksy has committed a criminal act here by destroying someone's property because it was not his. So lots of interesting questions. But Justin, my question for you is 1.4 million? 2.8 million? What would you pay for this quote-unquote piece of art?
I wouldn't pay anything for it before it was shredded.
Why? Why? That's what I'm most interested in.
Well, first of all, there's two major reasons here. First of all, I just don't find the style aesthetically interesting. It doesn't do anything for me. I look at it, I go, okay. It looks like somebody stenciled shit when you look at his art. Like when I was in the Netherlands, they had like the whole Banksy museum there or whatever, the whole Banksy exhibit. And I went through it and look, I don't look at it and go, this is terrible. Like it's when you go to LACMA, you're just like, wait, that's art? Or like when you touch the wall in LACMA and you think there's no art there and they go, hey, stop touching the art. And you're like, what? They're like, that line on the wall. That's art. I was like, that's art? That looks like terrible wallpaper. It's not like that.
Did you
like,
see that story where a kid going through his parents dropped a glove on the floor and for weeks people thought it was an exhibit?
No, but I believe it.
Wasn't there also awesome. Someone who fell down a hole? they had a hole on display and someone fell down it?
No, my favorite part of the LACMA is the rain room. Because they have so little rain, as we were talking about at the top, they have so little rain in Southern California that they made a room with fake rain as if that's art.
I love it. If anyone hasn't seen it, you should check out Will Ferrell and the guy who used to host The Soup. What's his name?
Joel McHale.
Joel McHale visit a modern art museum and basically just raucously make fun of the dumb art the entire time, and it is fantastic.
Right, so it's not Banksy isn't that, right? Like there's some amount of effort put into what Banksy does. It's just I don't really like it. If people like it, more power to you. At least he's a dude trying to do shit and people have a preference for it. There's some effort put into there to actually do something. I just don't like it. So that's the first thing is it's just not for me.
Is the effort destroy other people's property?
Well, that's the second part, okay? That is the second part. Not only is he destroying other people's shit, right? Not only is he like trying to tear shit down, but I don't even believe he's doing it to make a point. I believe it's all a marketing scheme. You say this is a prank, Daniel? I say this is a marketing scheme, okay? He takes on the ethos, as you were saying earlier, the ethos of being counterculture to make a shitload of money. He's not really counterculture. He just knows if he acts this way, the counterculture people are going to love him and pay him lots of money to make this shit. It's all a facade. So not only is it not terribly good, but it's based upon this idea of I'm going to destroy shit to fake destroy shit. Here's the question. Is he worse than Antifa? At least when you see these videos in Portland of the Antifa people standing in the middle of the street and yelling at people and telling them, go that way, go that way. They at least mean what they're saying. They're fucking douchebags, and I wish someone would actually run them over, unlike what happened in UVA, where they said someone run them over and they didn't. It was an accident. I wish someone actually would. But are they as bad as Banksy, who's pretending to be them?
Is he pretending or just trolling? Like, it's the best troll ever. I don't know. I tend to have more respect for the guy for doing this. It's the best troll ever.
Wait, so you think it's actually, like, three levels deep?
I think it's three levels deep. I think it's four-dimensional chess.
You think he's doing him and this Trump. Not just to make money.
Oh, Trump is Banksy.
Make fun of him.
Yes.
I just put that
yes.
together. Trump is Banksy. That'd be awesome. William, people were surprised that a graffiti artist destroyed a piece of property to make a point. Were you?
I was incredibly surprised because he did not follow the NSA CSS 02-01 shredding standard, which clearly states that you're supposed to shred it in pieces no larger than 1 millimeter by 5 millimeter. And yes, I do know that. I used to work there.
Wow.
So I'm completely disappointed that there was, it's clearly still a piece of art at the bottom, and if you properly shredded the document, you would not be able to tell what the document was. I'm completely surprised, frankly appalled, that this piss-poor job at shredding.
Yeah, it didn't even go all the way through.
I wonder if it ran out of battery or something. Like, it sort of, like, petered out there at the end. So
that is an interesting point, because he apparently set up this frame, like, years ago. So, endorsement deal with a battery company?
Yeah, this could have been an Energizer tie-in. They really missed the boat on this one.
So, Justin, somewhat to your point from earlier, this piece went from being a mediocre sort of stencil art to a piece that would be in LACMA real quickly, because now it's half shredded. And to me, none of it's art. It's all crap. It's a nice sketch, but he is not, in my book, an artist who holds a candle to any of the great masters in world history, and I pay him no mind because what he does is garbage. There, I said it. Banksy is garbage, and I like to move on with my life. So, it is not, one other point, it is not counterculture, to reinforce what Justin said, it is not counterculture to hate capitalism. In fact, it is mainstream, and you are not a hero. The end.
Well, yeah, that's one of their great ethos things, right? It's like when I go to, go to Warped Tour, because it's RIP Warped Tour, but it's like when I would go to Warped Tour and a band would be like, yeah, fuck the system, vote Democrat. And I'm like, wait, what? What? I don't understand right now. Is it Obama in office right now? Like, this doesn't make sense to me. All right.
Yeah, we need to have the You Are the Man pep talk with a lot of people.
You're such a hero because you hate capitalism, just like everyone else. Oh, so brave. So brave, Banksy. So brave.
So, Daniel, is Banksy's true art his marketing genius?
Sure.
He certainly knows his audience.
He can sell crap, so yes. Him and the guy who made the pet rock, both right up there. Geniuses.
Chia Pet, too?
That's right. Geniuses. Can you tell that I hate modern artists? I hate them. I hate them. No respect for Banksy. Screw that guy. Or girl. Whoever.
And not an endorsement, but if you want to see some real art, just Google Cordair Art Gallery, and you can find some good art. If you want to get this...
Cordair Art Gallery does not sponsor this podcast.
Exactly. If you want to see some nice art, go to their website and visit them in Napa Valley. It's fucking amazing.
Although, if they do want to sponsor this podcast...
They might want to sponsor the next section coming up, huh?
Yeah, we're going to talk about an artist that we've liked, and you know what he's doing now, and if we're going to continue to like him, it's time for the Hopeful Romantic with JML. About to lead off with a review here, as I always do in the Hopeful Romantic segment. But if you want exclusive reviews that are only available to Patreon subscribers, you have to become a Patreon subscriber. You can give as little as $1 an episode, and you can have access to those Patreon only reviews of movies such as Star Wars The Last Jedi. I think we also didn't we do the Solo movie, Daniel?
Did we? I don't know. I try to expunge that from my memory.
Well, no way to give it away for free. I'm here plugging, and you're giving it away for free.
I'm just here on the corner giving it away for free.
There are other movies from the past, and we will do other ones in the future. Patreon exclusive reviews on themidside.com/Patreon or patreon.com/themidside. Or you can now search for us on Patreon and just search Midside. Yay. And we'll come up. Yay! Not Shadow Band. This week, though, what I want to talk about is First Man. And I have to ask, did either of you see First Man?
I don't have a life anymore, so no.
I was planning on seeing it yesterday, but my date had to cancel at the last minute, so I have not seen it yet.
Wait, why did your date canceling mean you couldn't see a movie?
Because we were going to go together.
Yeah, but
we just rescheduled.
So I
had to stay home and cry.
Yeah, okay. See, that's the emo side of him. But I created a rule. So one of two things happens if someone cancels on me. I either continue to do the plans I agreed upon without them, because fuck them if you cancel on me, or I just go to the gym. That's why I always have a gym bag in the trunk of my car.
I like that rule, and I appreciate it, but we wanted to go together, and I'm sure we will reschedule it as soon as he doesn't get called into work, which is what happened.
That bicycle built for two ride must have been really awkward, Justin.
Yeah, right. Like I'd let somebody use my productive power. People, when you do that, they just make you do it all by yourself. I make people get their own bike and follow me.
All right, let's get to your review. I'm curious.
First Man, Damien Chazelle's new movie, Chazelle, I can never say his name correctly. He has made two great movies. La La Land is one of my absolute favorites. Whiplash is very good. Also a great movie that I would suggest seeing. Either of those are great. Check them out. This movie is him getting back together with Ryan Gosling. Ryan Gosling plays Neil Armstrong. And this is about the moon landing, but from the perspective of Neil Armstrong. What's interesting to me about this movie is it really, really, really pushes the boundary to make us assess the difference between realism and naturalism. Even
go
now,
on.
While I'm pausing and I'm thinking about what to say, because it's really it's really tough. Because there are two main ways to look at this movie. The first is stylistically. So stylistically, there are a lot of shots that are behind the characters or first person shots. So for instance, the famous image of him and Buzz Aldrin walking down the hall before they get on the shuttle and go into space. They show that shot and then turn it around, or he shows that shot and then turns it around and shows what it looked like from him when he was looking down the hall at the reporters. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of showing it from that perspective, which could come across very naturalistically. There's also stylistically not showing things completely how they happened. So naturalism is very much about, we're going to show everything exactly how it happened, and that's the only way it could happen. But here there's a lot of time jumps, and there's a lot of only showing it from Armstrong's perspective. So there's a clear effort here to stylistically only show things from Armstrong's perspective and how it affected him on a personal level. That's the thing I'm ultimately going to return to, is what is the point of this movie? What is the theme of this movie? So what it made me think about when watching this movie is naturalism, literally the word natural. What does the word natural mean, Daniel, philosophically? Because, and I'm going to have you answer, but I want to sort of lead it a little bit like you always do to me, is you could make the word natural not mean anything, because you could say that everything that happens in the world is natural, which you could even include what humans do. And if what humans do is natural, well, then our choice is natural, so the word natural becomes meaningless. You get what I'm saying?
Yes.
Right, so what does natural mean? Because that's what we really have to get to the heart of here.
So how it's used, historically speaking, and you pointed out the sort of false dichotomy, but how it's used, historically speaking, is that sort of which comes from nature and isn't created by man, doesn't come from humans.
Right. So it's very externally focused, right? The society, or literally the earth, the existence, the world.
Well, in art, then it would be like that which doesn't come from the characters. So not their choice, not their values, not their ideas, but what happens to them, what is put upon them.
Right. And this movie sort of toes that line in an interesting way, because fundamentally it's about what humans do, and specifically what Armstrong does, right? The entire space race, the entire expedition to the moon is all what we did. That does not come from nature. That is all based upon human choice. So you have to take that fundamentally as a base premise of this movie. But then the whole movie starts with, he has a 5-year-old daughter who dies of a tumor. And that sort of is his emotional through line throughout the movie, because that makes him distant from people throughout the entire movie. Now, he's still participating in this, right? He decides to try out for the Gemini. They don't say Gemini. They say Gemini, the Gemini program. And then he accepts all the missions and everything. But there's this through line of tragedy throughout it. And he overcomes that tragedy, and he is able to be the first man who lands on the moon. But the emphasis in this movie is not necessarily showing the celebration of the overcoming. It's the difficulty of dealing with that. And this is where the line between naturalism and realism is very razor thin. Because the realism that naturalism plays with or uses as an excuse to make naturalism is saying that we all have to deal with that suffering, which is true. We all have elements of suffering. And in this movie, it's his daughter dying and all the people that he worked with dying, right? The three astronauts that burned up on the platform for the first Apollo mission. He knew those people well. And they make that point in the movie that all these pilots he knew kept dying when he was around them. I mean, that's it's the same. He's no different from a soldier where you see all these people. But naturalism plays with that, and it uses that to seduce us and say, oh, well, that means that we can never escape suffering and it must be what drives us. Whereas this is sort of showing the opposite in a very interesting way. And I'm not sure Chazelle executes it 100%, but the point is he succeeds and he becomes a great man, but there's still a chasm between him and other people. And it's interesting to me because it's sort of in the same era as Mad Men, and Mad Men sort of had the same point, that there's this deep loneliness in society that great men, or just men in general, and I mean that as humans, or maybe I mean men in general, I don't know, I'd have to think about it more, that they suffer and deal with, or maybe it's all life is that loneliness. And that's the point of the movie. So it's not naturalism because it doesn't just say life is suffering and we can't achieve anything, but it addresses the fact that there is suffering in life, and how we deal with it is who defines, or is what defines who we are. I would say really that's what the movie's about. It's the same thing with sort of Man of Steel, right? Man of Steel, you have to take the word man seriously in the title. Well, here you have to take the word first man seriously. You have to take man seriously. And this is sort of Chazelle's view of man. So even though he's had two wonderfully romantic movies that really celebrate things, we sort of see his realistic view of man is not a very positive one here. I would say it's more in line with Jordan Peterson than it is Ayn Rand. As far
that was
as
certainly the name that came to mind during your description. So
yeah, I think Jordan Peterson would love this movie. I really think he would. And as far as seeing it, look, I didn't hate it. I enjoyed it. I mean, but I'm also like, I loved going to when my family went to Houston and saw the Space Center when I was young. I just loved that stuff when I was young. You know, I'm huge into sci-fi like William is. So seeing this story was just something that I'm a nerd for it. So that probably played into it to my enjoying it. I don't know if I would have been interested if I didn't care about space, if I didn't like this stuff. I know my girlfriend was bored by it. She said it several times during the movie, and I understood why. It's a very slow movie, and it's a very intimate movie. It's very just focused on Neil Armstrong, and he doesn't say a lot in the movie.
She
fell asleep multiple times, and I understand why. I'm not mad at her for it. I get why she fell asleep. So you may not enjoy it, and I do not think it compares. I think he did what he wanted to do. I think Chazelle did what he wanted to do, but I don't think it compares to La La Land or Whiplash. I don't.
That's interesting. Would it be worth it for me to go to Baltimore to see it on the 70mm IMAX?
I think especially towards the end where there is I don't want to make it seem like there isn't celebration. Some of the shots of the rocket that goes to the moon And the launch and everything are fucking beautiful. They're amazing. And Gosling's performance is great. Like, there's a point in the beginning where I really wasn't emotionally connected with the movie, but there's a point where it's like a close-up of him crying over his daughter's death in the beginning. Like, he goes to a room by himself and starts crying. And it made me want to cry because of how good the performance is. So I think if you want to see just the pure technical part of that movie, I think it's worth seeing on a 70 millimeter. but I don't think you necessarily have to. It's not one that I would say, like a Christopher Nolan movie, that it's really worth seeing, or a Zack Snyder movie that it's really worth seeing.
Interesting. And my final question for you is, was it as anti-American as the conservative snowflakes tried to make it out to be?
No, especially I paid attention to that, and I wouldn't, honestly, I thought about that during the movie, and I wouldn't have even noticed that if that had never been put in my fucking head, because there's a goddamn wide shot before they leave the moon. There's a goddamn wide shot of the lunar lander with the American flag next to it. They just literally don't show Armstrong planting the flag, because they show him dropping a thing from his dead daughter into a crater. Because that's what the movie's about. It's not about planting the American flag. And they have that wide shot. They have the American flag being raised at a certain point, and then they have the whole "we have to beat the Russians" thing in there. So it's definitely pro-American. It's just that I think that somebody leaked that to try and make the movie fail with the audience it's intended for, because this is not intended for a left-wing audience. It's intended for a more right-wing audience, which is ironic, because this was another thought I had when watching it. They had the people in there arguing that this was a waste of money because there were other things that could be fixed on Earth rather than, you know, trying to get to the moon, which does nothing for us, which is seemingly a more conservative point of view nowadays, or at least libertarian. So it was interesting that that was in there, but this is for a more conservative audience.
Well, I'd like to see it.
I think it's worth seeing. I don't want to. Yeah, I think I'll see
it when it comes out on Apple TV. I don't think it's something I'm going to rush out to the movie theater to see.
Yeah, and that's the way I feel coming out of it. I would have, after having seen it, I would have rather seen Bad Times at the Al Royale, because that seems like a movie that's more up my alley stylistically. And I think I'm probably going to end up liking that movie a lot more. I'm going to review it next week. I think that that's going to be the better movie, and this could have waited till later. But you know what? I'm glad I saw it, and I'm glad there's the other thought I had while watching it. I'm glad there's artists out there nowadays, writer directors, that I will see just because of how good they are. Because there's so many that I won't see because of how bad they are. All right, let's move forward, and we can talk about actually one of those writer directors that I usually will see because I like his stuff, especially as of late. We're going to go into Trailer Takedown here, and as always, if you want to watch the trailers before we talk about them, you can do so on the midside.com/podcast. They're always on there, and you can, you know, watch them all at once, or you can pause the episode as we're talking about them and watch them that way. However you want to do it, the trailers for the episode are always up, at least on Saturday is the late. I've been doing that recently. Usually I put them up on Saturday.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
A Dog's Way Home is based on a book about a dog that gets separated from her owner and finds her way home to him. Look, I'm not gonna hate on this movie, okay? There's any number of things I could say, but didn't Homeward Bound already do this? That was my main thing. Was I was like, this
I like the cartoon version nice. Called Bolt.
Yeah, Bolt is the same movie. So this movie's been done a bunch of times before. It doesn't look like it's terribly made. It just kind of looks like this is a movie. This is a movie that, it has a good heart at its core. It's not saying anything terribly awful about the world. It's meant to, like, rouse your emotions and make you feel warm and go, ah. A movie like this, I don't want to hug, but I don't want to tackle it either. It's just a movie, and people are going to like it, and that doesn't bother me. So, like, can I punt on one?
No. No.
Okay, so for me personally, there's too much else out there I would want to see. And also, there's a weird subtext making the dog a woman. Maybe I'm the only one who interpreted the trailer weirdly, but I thought it was this weird subtext that she's a woman and going back to her male owner. A little weird. But for me personally, I would not begrudge anyone if this is a movie they wanted to see. And I might end up seeing it because my girlfriend's probably going to want to see it. So, Daniel?
I thought this was called Marley and Me, but you want to make a lot of money in the movie business, Justin? Like a lot of money for not a lot of effort? Just make this movie. Just make it again, straight up. Just take the entire plot, copy it, make it with a different dog. You'll make a gazillion dollars. This movie will make way more money at the box office than anyone anticipates because this is the kind of movie that families can take their kids to and not have to worry about it, and is the sort of middle America wanting more of family-friendly stuff, less shooting and sex stuff. So I get it. I get why these movies are made. That being said, oh, God, I couldn't even make it through the trailer. It was so just ridiculously sweet and nauseating, and I don't know. I don't begrudge, like you say, I don't begrudge people this, but no, not for me. Tackle.
Yeah, I think the word you're looking for is saccharine. It's that's overly the word. Sweet. It's just, it's... I don't
I'm a
say
cute
anything.
Little puppy.
Yeah,
look
I don't
want to
say anything bad about
eyes.
It either, other than it looks way too sweet for something that I could enjoy. This is a movie I would fall asleep in, and I love dogs. My dog just looked at me like, what? I love Colt too, but I love other dogs as well. But I fear for the parents who do take their children to this movie and then all have to go buy a puppy. So go to the shelter, please. Don't buy a puppy. Tackle.
It's interesting, William, that you say that your dog started looking at you now, because my cat came over to me and started like touching me with her paw. So it's like
you're not getting a dog, are you?
They're calling. They're calling us out. Although you made me realize something, Daniel. I want to see the satire of this movie starring Scrappy Doo, about Scrappy Doo getting separated from his owner. Who is Scrappy Doo's owner, by the way? Maybe Scrappy Doo, really, the reason he's annoying is he wants attention so badly because he's been separated from his owner and he has separation anxiety. And finally, he is going to use his dog instincts to go back to his owner. I think I just pitched a movie.
I want to see the satire of this starring a cat who, when the owner leaves, like, she doesn't notice. So.
What was Homeward Bound only had three dogs? There were no cats?
I don't know.
Don't you
remember? Wasn't there, like, Milo's Adventure or
That's
something?
That's what I was going to say. Milo Notice had a cat and a dog.
Yeah.
These movies were done better in the 90s.
Always.
Second trailer.
Glass is the sequel to Split and Unbreakable by writer-director M. Night Shyamalan, whatever his name is. M. Night Shyamalan.
Chazelle.
He is known as ruiner of live-action Avatar. That is his full name.
That's the thing. He's made some bad movies, right? But overall, his body of work is good. He has some really good movies. And I think maybe my favorite two by him might be Unbreakable and Split. And then he has this one, which is going to be the sequel to it. And this movie starts out with the three characters, Mr. Glass, played by Samuel Jackson, Dunn, played by Bruce Willis, and then James McAvoy's character, who's like a paranoid schizophrenic, got like 23 characters in his head, all in an insane asylum together. And even though in Unbreakable and Split, they've all been proven to have powers of some sort, this psychiatrist is trying to convince them that they're insane. And I like that they went there in this beginning, and I like that M. Night went in this direction. And I'm in for this movie. I just wish the trailer hadn't shown the entire fucking movie. Like, I feel like I've watched the movie now in this trailer, which is disappointing because I was already sold. So, hug. But fuck you, marketing team. Daniel?
The only of these movies that I've seen is Sixth Sense. So, I just can't watch it because I have no idea what's going on. So I was confused by the trailer. Also, no. Tackle.
Well, Sixth Sense has nothing to do with this franchise. This is Unbreakable and Split.
Oh, see, I didn't even know because I thought Bruce Willis, Sixth Sense, M. Night Shyamalan.
No, watch Unbreakable. That's your homework assignment. Watch Unbreakable, William.
No.
So I have watched Unbreakable. I have not watched Split. So now I'm thinking maybe I should watch Split because this looks fun and interesting. And I didn't know that there was a cameo of Dunn in Split. So I'm going to give this a tentative hug.
Hug.
Yeah, when I got to Split, I had no idea it was a sequel to Unbreakable. You don't know until the very end. It's like a post-credit scene. And they do this whole thing with James McAvoy. And Split is actually very anti-social justice. So I think it's worth seeing just for that. The theme is tremendous in Split. And then you get to the end and they reveal Bruce Willis, David Dunn. And I totally marked out when I saw that. I was like, this is incredible. Like a secret sequel to Unbreakable years later. Amazing.
Final trailer.
The Aladdin live action teaser trailer was finally released. And all I could think at the end of it was, why is he wearing a shirt under his vest? And why is the fez so big on his head? That's how much of a nerd I am. So putting that aside, because we've always, you know, I always talk about different mediums need different interpretations, and these people who want the strict interpretations, that's wrong. So even though I had that initial reaction, so I identify with you guys, I identify, but let's move past that. I thought the graphics in this were good. I thought this was appealing. This teased me sufficiently. This teased me sufficiently and made me want to see this. There was nothing, even though I'm worried about this, the only sort of worrisome thing in this trailer was they had to use Friend Like Me as the background music. I would have gone with like Arabian Nights. Because this
it was,
you know,
Arabian Nights at
the
beginning. It was Arabian Nights at the beginning.
Yeah, it went a little bit of Arabian Nights, and then it went into Friend Like Me almost immediately, which I was sort of disappointed in. So maybe they're just going to use the genie for marketing. I don't know. It doesn't matter. I loved this. I thought this was a great teaser. There's nothing that dissuaded me. I thought the Cave of Wonders looked tremendous when they showed that part. So I'm still in. I'm going to see it regardless, but I'm excited. Hug. Daniel?
No need to bury the lead. Hug. Gonna see it. 100%. As one of my all-time favorite Disney movies. I did think Aladdin looked strange. Of course, no Aladdin is going to look like the animated Aladdin, because, you know, animation. But it looked off in some way. And I'm wondering if that's final, or if this was, you know, cut early as a marketing piece, unclear. So things may change. Boy, oh, hug.
Hug.
Sorry.
Yeah, I saw Iago. I did not hear Iago. And that has me worried. And the reason it has me worried is not because I think they should go scene for scene or completely, you know, make it a translation into live action. But the kind of irreverent humor that came from Iago and Apu, I'm worried that that's not going to be in here. Because if you remember, when this movie came out originally, they had to change the lyrics of Arabian Nights. And I'm wondering how much more they're going to need to change in today's SJW culture. It has me really worried. And I'm not, maybe I'm suffering from PTSD after all the STD stuff from Star Trek Discovery, the absolute destruction of a franchise. I'm worried. But with that worry aside, everything you guys said is right. The music sounds good. It didn't knock me over, but it sounded good. I'm hoping this music was just for the trailer. But it's okay. The visuals looked really cool. I really like the Cave of Wonders. I am tentatively hugging this.
Hug!
Ready for real Aladdin nerd stuff?
Sure. Always.
So what you're saying, William, they actually had in the writer's room for Aladdin, or the animator's room, they had something written on the wall, and it said, "When in doubt, hurt the bird."
Yeah, yeah.
So that's about the Iago thing you're talking about. So they were very aware of that. And that's definitely with the genie, right? I mean, the genie is very irreverent in the way he is and over the top. And Robin Williams kind of made the reference humor a big part of that before it was even a big thing in our culture. With the not having the voice, though, here's two things. One, I'm just happy Iago's in it, because that means Abu's probably in it as well. Because one of the things I don't like about the musical, the Broadway musical, and even the California Adventure stage show they had, is there was no Abu in it. And they gave Aladdin like three friends, which is completely like against the point, where you're my only friend, Abu, right? He says that in jump ahead.
Yeah.
Where they had to change that for the Broadway musical, where he's like, I could use a friend or two. That's how they changed that lyric. So the fact that Iago and Abu are in it at all is a huge win on my
perspective. Is Abu in it?
In my perception.
Did you see
Abu? I didn't see Abu, but if they're going to have Iago, I think they're going to have Abu.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Has anyone checked out the cast for this? It's interesting.
Yeah.
There is no actor credited for Iago.
That was the second thing I was going to say. Do we really want to have someone besides Gilbert Godfrey voice Iago? I'd rather him be mute than them recast him.
Yeah.
So I mean, the cast is interesting. Like, Jasmine isn't even that hot, which is disappointing. Like,
there will be no midriff for her either, by the way. So weird. That is going the way of Iago.
Well, if we're going to go through characters, though, genie. Jafar has to be, like, the genie has to be perfect, but Jafar has to be perfect, too. Jafar is perhaps the best Disney villain, right? Like, you have to get that perfect, so.
Do you know who the genie is, William?
I do, but I was told that looking at the cast list was spoilers when I was talking to, when I told Justin that this preview was up. So, and I was like, they don't have anyone cast for so-and-so and so-and-so. And he was like, spoilers. I was like, okay.
Well, I hadn't watched the trailer yet. I didn't want you to spoil the trailer for me.
Well, if anyone's interested, go look at who the genie is. I think
you can say
could be a brilliant choice. Could be.
It is a brilliant choice. One of my favorite actors over my entire life has been Will Smith. I am glad he is the genie.
Yeah. And it's because you can't go with a Robin Williams light. It just doesn't work. You just have to go in a completely different direction.
Yeah.
With it.
Yep.
So.
And Will Smith.
Optimistic.
Got famous on his comedy chops, so I think he's a great choice for it. I do.
Yeah. It could have been Sinbad. It was basically in his name already. He's already cast.
Was in that genie movie, remember?
Oh yeah, he was a genie. That's right. He's already got a resume to prove it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on.
All right, let's move on to the final segment here. We're going to talk about a thing that I've talked about with Daniel a lot off air, and I just want to talk about it on air because I think it's an important self-reflective question in today's day and age. So let's do it in Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. Recently on this segment, we've been talking about a lot of questions that I bring up. But really, we'd love to talk about questions that you have. Do you need advice? Do you have thoughts you want to see us or hear us discuss? Because it's an audio show, not a visual show. Come on, Justin. Submit it. Submit it to us. You can do it. William, where's a great place for them to submit their questions?
Well, you can go to Discord, and you can get that link from the show notes on themidside.com/podcast. Just join our Discord server, and you can chat with other listeners, you can talk to us, and if you are on Patreon and you link to your Patreon account, you'll join the super secret voice and text channels just for our Patreon subscribers.
There you go. So submit to us so you're not just listening to what I think about, because really what I think about is fucking insane, like a war. But part of this whole discussion, you know, this whole idea is premised on, you know, that there's this privilege that exists that's unseen, and if you don't realize all these injustices that people are saying, you have the privilege without realizing it. And they've been relying on this argument, you know, progressives, the left, whoever, has been relying on this argument, this premise that anyone who doesn't agree with progress is because they're stuck in the old archaic cultural norms. You know, they're just not willing to get past what they accepted to be true, and they're not willing and ready to grow. Whereas the rest of us are open-minded. That's the argument they use. And the question I have for the two of you is, how do you know they're not right? How do you know you're not just stuck in the old archaic cultural norms? I mean, when you talk about things like transgender, that's something I have a major issue with, right? Because I don't understand why the answer when you have something wrong in your mind is just to start cutting and disfiguring your body. Why don't you treat the mind? Why do you think because the mind is having issues and pain and suffering, you change the body? That doesn't make sense to me. But they would say, oh, well, you're just stuck in the old gender binary. So how do you know? Where is the line between progress continuing and the way the world actually is? How do you know that?
Well, this is a deep question, Justin. One for which there is not a very simple answer that we can give in a podcast. But here we go. So knowledge isn't in a vacuum, right? So when we have knowledge, it, one, has to conform with reality, and also, you know, we take what we knew in the past and we figure out where it fits in with that. And it is a rare day that when you learn something new, everything you knew before that is invalidated, unless you've made some serious error of reasoning, especially on these large questions, these large philosophical, sociological, psychological questions. When we get new knowledge, and if we've correctly identified what we know in the past and it conforms with reality, the new knowledge will fit into our world, or all the past information will fit nicely into what we know now, either direction. So, when you say things like, you know, you feel like an old man with transgender or whatever it is, you can learn things like that people are born with different sets of genitalia, for instance, like competing sets of genitalia, and they don't easily fit into the man-woman binary, and they might have to have surgery to correct that, and that makes perfect sense because it fits into your hierarchy of knowledge and all the things you know about the world. But when someone says, well, I want to have surgery even though I don't have competing sets of genitalia, and I identify as a woman, I just say I'm a woman, therefore I am a woman, well, that's not new knowledge. That's sort of the opposite of new knowledge, right? That's contra what we actually know about the world. And that's because it's an assertion, and there's no proof, there's no evidence to suggest that you should change the entirety of everything you've ever known about gender, biology, sexuality, etc., to conform to this new thing. It's that there's something wrong with this new thing. Now, that was a mixture of abstraction and concrete, but I hope I made a point.
Yeah, I think that history, the fact that we don't have folks that take a philosophical interest in history means that they miss context. Like we just talked about in the article today about abolishing the Supreme Court. None of the arguments there are new arguments. There's new context, like in a modern context, maybe, and that would be interesting to discuss. But the fact that they're presented as new arguments, like no one's ever thought about this before, is laughable. And there's a difference between understanding history and putting things in that historical context. And I think like Pinker's book does a good job of that, right? And then Enlightenment Now book, and being stuck in history, right? And there are some conservatives that are stuck in history, but guess what? We in the mid-side, we're not conservatives, right? And
that's right.
And there's tons of nice, interesting new knowledge that we generate that help us modify and bring more context to our old knowledge, and maybe even make corrections to things that were wrong. But that's not how the left approaches knowledge, right? It's very emotionalist and very now. The kind of historical, I mean, they'll say a lot about historical patriarchy, but they won't understand it, right? They won't take the time to understand what actually happened in the past and understand the context of the past. I mean, we see that dropped context all the time, the way they judge historical figures by today's standards, which doesn't make any sense. And it's the integration of the past and our current knowledge that helps you decide how to act and what things to advocate for today. And if there's anything that's destroyed that, it's been the way history is taught, the way kids are exposed to history. It's all social science now. It's all social studies. It's no, there's no actual history anymore. And people are just, they just don't know. They don't understand the context of why things are the way they are today and where we came from.
And part of it, of course, Justin, as you know, as well as anyone else, is having a firm base of philosophic principles that you understand and that are non-contradictory and that conform with reality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that you can build off of. Now, I'm actually an advocate for, you know, you don't have to like set it and forget it. It's not the Ron Popeil philosophy. Like, you can check back in every so often and make sure that you're not, that these core principles haven't changed. They're still non-contradictory. They still conform with reality, et cetera. But for the most part, once those are solidified, you don't have to feel like every bit of new information that comes in is integrated into your consciousness should obliterate those things. That's what all knowledge is built on, that. It should be a rewarding thing. And when something blatantly doesn't make sense, you can go back and check your premises, to use a phrase. But for the most part, you're going to find, no, I'm still sure I'm right. I'm still sure my premises are correct. Therefore, this new bit of quote-unquote information is actually no such thing. It's propaganda, or it's a lie, or it's disintegrated, or whatever it is.
I agree with you, and ultimately the answer seems to be read a book, seems to be the answer here. the thing to me, and this goes back to what I was saying in the first segment, when you're presented with something that's so diametrically opposed from what you believe, and then they say, oh, well, you're the one who is behind the times and you're regressive. Is that just something you can just dismiss offhand because of the argumentation style?
It's something I can dismiss offhand because I'm confident in what I know. Now, if someone presents new evidence for something, that's very different from making an assertion about something. So if someone says, your understanding of reality is totally warped and here's why, and they give me 10 reasons that I can investigate for myself, that would be totally different. That has never happened. What happens is you don't get it because you're a privileged, white, sexist, whatever. And then, you know, I could go and investigate, as I did in college, all the people writing the philosophy behind this, John Rawls and Martha Nussbaum and all these other horrible human beings, and see the flaws in their logic that led to these horrible assertions. But the assertions don't shake me at all. Assertions are nothing. They're what we talked about a couple episodes ago, right? They're arbitrary.
Well,
it's proven.
It's not just a couple episodes ago. I think it's almost like this question has to do with the opening of it. And you're saying, like Melania Trump said, that you need evidence and you can't just rely on ethos. And all of these claims are ethos-based, and it's an attack on your ethos. And I think ultimately the important thing to remember is you build your own ethos. And now this is where things get really interesting. What matters most is the way you see yourself, your ethos towards yourself. And I think that's what matters the most in building here. Read a book, build your self-esteem, and you will be in touch enough with reality to sort of not be able to, I lost the word, but to be immune. That's the word I'm looking for, to immune to this sort of style of quote-unquote argumentation.
Absolutely.
All right, I think that's a good place to end. So what did we learn this trip? William?
I learned that we live in a liberal democracy, so therefore we should abolish the Supreme Court and, I don't know, just have a direct democracy. I think we should just vote on whether every person should be able to exist or not.
Don't give them any ideas.
Daniel?
I learned that we have the wrong Trump as president.
I actually agree with that, I think.
Melania, 2020.
But she's an immigrant.
Oh, damn it. That's right.
If only we could get the Supreme Court. No, we just have the Supreme Court decide. Or the president give an executive order. Democracy, man.
That's right. Democracy. We'll just have 51% of the people vote and then it'll be true. So, Justin, what did you learn?
This week I learned a little bit more about the difference between realism and naturalism and where that lies and how the people who are creators and proponents of naturalism use realism and use a Jordan Peterson perspective on realism to make naturalism seem better and more appealing.
Fair enough. Well, I hope all of you Midsiders learned something out there. I don't know how much shilling I'm supposed to do at the end of the show because I don't have any show notes here.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you can follow us on social media. People have tuned out at this point. I mean,
leave us some reviews on iTunes and Google Plus. Buy a t-shirt at themidside.com/store. And go thank Liberty.me for syndicating us. But till next time. See ya.
Yeah, remember, Daniel, what are they supposed to leave in their reviews this week? Brains.
Brains.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Brains.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Elmazeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
Daniel, did you see that the Cowboys are beating the Jaguars 37-7?
37-7?
Yes. I thought the Jaguars were the best team in the AFC. Am I wrong?
The Jaguars had their Super Bowl this year. It was against the Patriots. Now they're done for the season.
How did we get through a whole episode and not celebrate the Michigan win over Wisconsin?
Because we really need to record an episode of Belichick Your Premises. That's what we're.
That's right. It's getting all pent up. We're like a. It's like a week pent up. We've got to.
We're getting blue footballs.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Blue footballs. We need to do this.